You're listening to continuing coverage of President Donald Trump's address to a joint session of Congress, live from Washington on The Voice of America.
And Ryan is looking down right now, you know that, and he's very happy because I think he just broke a record. For as the Bible teaches us, there is no greater act of love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. Ryan laid down his life for his friends, for his country, and for our freedom. And we will never forget Ryan. To those allies who wonder what kind of a friend America will be, look no further than the heroes who wear our uniform. Our foreign policy calls for a direct, robust, and meaningful engagement with the world. It is American leadership based on vital security interests that we share with our allies all across the globe. We strongly support NATO, an alliance forged through the bonds of two world wars that dethroned fascism and the Cold War and defeated communism. But our partners must meet their financial obligations. And now, based on our very strong and frank discussions, they are beginning to do just that. In fact, I can tell you the money is pouring in. Very nice. Very nice. We expect our partners, whether in NATO, the Middle East, or in the Pacific, to take a direct and meaningful role in both strategic and military operations and pay their fair share of the cost. Have to do that. We will respect historic institutions, but we will respect the foreign rights of all nations, and they have to respect our rights as a nation also. Free nations are the best vehicle for expressing the will of the people, and America respects the right of all nations to chart their own path. My job is not to represent the world. My job is to represent the United States of America. But we know that America is better off when there is less conflict, not more. We must learn from the mistakes of the past. We have seen the war and the destruction that have ravaged and raged throughout the world, all across the world. The only long-term solution for these humanitarian disasters, in many cases, is to create the conditions where displaced persons can safely return home and begin the long, long process of rebuilding. America is willing to find new friends and to forge new partnerships where shared interests align. We want harmony and stability, not war and conflict. We want peace wherever peace can be found. America is friends today with former enemies. Some of our closest allies decades ago fought on the opposite side of these terrible, terrible wars. This history should give us all faith in the possibilities for a better world. Hopefully, the 250th year for America will see a world that is more peaceful, more just, and more free. On our 100th anniversary in 1876, citizens from across our nation came to Philadelphia to celebrate America's centennial. At that celebration, the country's builders and artists and inventors showed off their wonderful creations. Alexander Graham Bell displayed his telephone for the first time. Remington unveiled the first typewriter. An early attempt was made at electric light. Thomas Edison showed an automatic telegraph and an electric pen. Imagine the wonders our country could know in America's 250th year. Think of the marvels we can achieve if we simply set free the dreams of our people. Cures to the illnesses that have always plagued us are not too much to hope. American footprints on distant worlds are not too big a dream. Millions lifted from welfare to work is not too much to expect. And streets where mothers are safe from fear, schools where children learn in peace, and jobs where Americans prosper and grow are not too much to ask. When we have all of this, we will have made America greater than ever before. For all Americans, this is our vision. This is our mission. But we can only get there together. We are one people with one destiny. We all bleed the same blood. We all salute the same great American flag. And we all are made by the same God. When we fulfill this vision, when we celebrate our 250 years of glorious freedom, we will look back on tonight as when this new chapter of American greatness began. The time for small thinking is over. The time for trivial fights is behind us. We just need the courage to share the dreams that fill our hearts. The bravery to express the hopes that stir our souls, and the confidence to turn those hopes and those dreams into action. From now on, America will be empowered by our aspirations, not burdened by our fears. Inspired by the future, not bound by failures of the past. And guided by a vision, not blinded by our doubts. I am asking all citizens to embrace this renewal of the American spirit. I am asking all members of Congress to join me in dreaming big and bold and daring things for our country. I am asking everyone watching tonight to seize this moment, believe in yourselves, believe in your future, and believe once more in America. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States.
We cannot allow a beachhead of terrorism to form inside America. We cannot allow our nation to become a sanctuary for extremists. Those the words of President Donald Trump speaking his first time before a joint session of Congress. President Trump speaking for about 65 minutes, just about average for a speech of this sort before members of Congress. Perhaps what may not have been so average about this speech was its breadth and depth. We have VOA correspondents joining us here now to break down what we've heard. And as we wait for the Democratic response, A Democratic response coming up shortly. Basically, at this point, the president's taking applause, leaving the speaker's rostrum. He will make his way outside the House chamber, but as he does so, he will be greeting members of Congress, diplomats, and others in his way. Jim Malone, senior national correspondent, joins us now. Jim Malone, this struck me as an unusual speech, just given its breadth. Was there a coherent philosophy or message behind all of this stuff that we heard tonight?
I'm sure they would argue the coherent philosophy is to make America great again. But I must say I was struck by the fact that we did not see a Donald Trump campaign speech tonight. We did see a speech that was long on ambition, but perhaps somewhat short on details, specifics. It was primarily domestic in nature, dealt with things like revitalizing the economy, tightening our borders, an interesting comment about immigration, his hopes for perhaps some sort of compromise on how to deal with the millions of undocumented immigrants already in the country, but also some interesting passages on dealing with the rest of the world. At one point saying, I don't represent the world, I represent the United States. Right. Those are my priorities, that's my interest. But also setting out a philosophy on willing to deal with different nations from a point of peace and not necessarily conflict, and of course allies. Allies are fine, but they also have to pay up, as we heard him say.
And also, basically, it seemed to be a perspective that says we are willing to negotiate and to deal with just about anybody, but just about everybody should not take the United States for granted, either economically in trade relations or in military or political relations as well.
Yes, and also near the end of his address, an effort again to appeal to national unity. We saw this a bit in his inaugural address on January 20th. We saw this a bit when he won the election back in November. Whether this will have the effect of winning over people, it's too early to say. Most of the applause, the interruptions, the cheering was done by Republicans.
Almost
we could see it here on the monitors because that side of the chamber would rise up and would be applauding. So we know that's true. When he got one of the biggest roars he got was when he went back to the campaign pledge of wanting to repeal and replace Obamacare.
That and building a wall, as I marked down, two of the biggest applause lines in this speech. White House correspondent Steve Herman joins us now as President Trump continues his make his way down the center aisle of the House chamber and out from that chamber. Steve, a tempered Donald Trump we heard today. What was it that you were hearing in this speech?
Well, I think definitely this is the best speech that he's probably ever given. A lot of care and thought went into it, much more than the inaugural speech. And as predicted, it was much brighter than that dark inaugural speech. Now, these speeches, usually they're the State of the Union, as you mentioned, every year. They're a cornucopia of promises. But I think this is the first time I've heard a president literally promise everything. He said, quote, everything that is broken in our country can be fixed. Every problem can be solved. Well, that is, something incredible. And, as we heard, he really covered the gamut.
Right.
But I think there were some very specific things that are going to set off a tremendous debate. Obviously, his assertion that, quote, Obamacare is collapsing, and also talking about changing the immigration system to more of a merit-based system like some other countries use. So this is something, it's a huge buffet he's put out there, and it's going to take a long time to digest.
Well put. There also may be a bit of a danger. If you put that much out there, you may be setting yourself or your party eventually up for disappointment. If you promise the moon and you can't deliver it, people will remember that you didn't deliver on your promises.
Right. There's members of Congress who are already saying that there's just no way that he's going to get what he wants. He specifically said that he's going to ask Congress to approve legislation to produce $1 trillion investment in infrastructure in the country. I don't think anybody would argue that there is much more money needed for infrastructure, but whether, you know, he's going to be able to get that sort of money, I'll leave up to my colleagues who cover Congress to comment on that.
Well, let's turn exactly now to VOA congressional correspondent Michael Bowman. Michael, you were there in the chamber. Tell us what it was that you were hearing, and particularly, you know, we have a sense of it watching on TV, but what was the reaction like, and what do you think sold in that chamber, and what didn't?
Well, indeed, I was standing directly above the podium where the president spoke, perhaps about 30 feet above in the press gallery, and I was struck immediately by the optics when President Trump entered the House chamber. There was almost no movement from Democrats whatsoever. In fact, many Democrats had cleared the aisle, the seats closest to the center aisle where the president strolled down. And there was this incredible moment when the president looked to the side and saw a number of Democratic senators like Robert Menendez of New Jersey. They locked eyes. No one moved an inch. Mm. No one reached out to shake a hand. And it struck me that there are many Democratic lawmakers who absolutely cannot and do not, for their political survival, want any photos to appear of them shaking Donald Trump's hand. That is the sort of thing that could play against them in a Democratic primary. And it is something that they simply cannot afford. Republicans, on the other hand, were genuinely enthused throughout the speech. There were some points where not each and every Republican was standing and applauding, particularly when he struck a particularly protectionist tone mm-hmm. when it came to trade. But nevertheless, there seemed to be this understanding among Republicans that Donald Trump is their guy and that through his success, many of the things that they have wanted to achieve for a very long time could actually occur. And there seemed to be a sense within the room of House and Senate Republicans wanting to buck up Donald Trump and to be seen cheering him. But overall, obviously, whenever you have a Republican president, Democrats are mostly going to be silent during a speech of this sort, and mm-hmm. vice versa. The Republicans did the same thing during President Obama's speeches. But the extent to which Democrats sat absolutely stone-faced in absolute silence during so much of President Trump's speech this evening was truly striking.
At least nobody called anybody else a liar in this speech. We have just a few minutes to go. We're waiting to hear from former Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear. He was a Democratic governor of Kentucky, and he will be delivering the Democratic response. But I'd like to, if I can, see if we can get each of you in the last moments before this. First to you, Michael Bowman, on this issue of immigration, which perhaps seems to be, you know, maybe the ultimate or penultimate issue facing the United States Congress at this moment. I wrote down on the script here, all through his discussion, blah. And by blah, I simply meant that what I was hearing from Republicans was, boy, there's not a lot of, you know, enthusiasm for this, and the Democrats were sitting on their hands.
Well, immigration reform has been a thorny topic long before Donald Trump became president. And even when Democrats controlled both houses of Congress and you had a Democratic president, there wasn't very much movement on it. But you have to remember that immigration is one of those things that, as President Barack Obama demonstrated, can be greatly affected by executive orders, by actions coming out of the White House. Donald Trump has demonstrated this as well just in the first few weeks of his presidency. No one is holding their breath that there's going to be some sort of bipartisan legislation, a meeting of the minds that will pass through both houses of Congress. I'm not saying it's impossible, but given the history of this institution where I'm sitting right now, the prospects don't look good, that the ideological gulfs can be bridged. Nevertheless, there is a lot that can be done on an executive basis, mm-hmm. and there are many things that a Republican-led Congress can fund, such as construction of a wall, if they are so determined to do, on their own, with only Republican votes and bypassing the Senate filibuster.
Steve Herman, do you think this White House believes it has enough mojo, enough political capital to draw Democrats to create some kind of bipartisan reform here?
I think not at the moment. I think that's going to be very difficult for all the reasons my colleagues have outlined. And I think the question is going to be is just how hard they're going to try. This is not the type of bipartisan give and take that we had in decades past. This is a very divisive country now. There is a huge political divide, and
we're going to have to stop it there, Steve Herman. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to go to Lexington, Kentucky.
I was governor of Kentucky from 2007 to 2015. Now I'm a private citizen. I'm here in Lexington, Kentucky, some 400 miles from Washington, at a diner with some neighbors, Democrats and Republicans, where we just watched the president's address. I'm a proud Democrat, but first and foremost, I'm a proud Republican and Democrat and mostly American. And like many of you, I am worried about the future of this nation. Look, I grew up in Kentucky in a small town called Dawson Springs. My dad and granddad were Baptist preachers. My family owned a funeral home. And my wife, Jane, and I have been married for almost 50 years. I became governor at the start of the global recession. And after 8 years, we left things a lot better than we found them. By being fiscally responsible, I even cut my own pay, we balanced our budget and turned deficits into surpluses without raising taxes. We cut our unemployment rate in half. We made huge gains in high school graduation rates. And we found health coverage for over 500,000 Kentuckians. We did that through trust and mutual respect. I listened, and I built partnerships with business leaders and with Republicans in our legislature. We put people first and politics second. The America I love allowed a small-town preacher's kid to be elected governor, and it taught me to embrace people who are different from me, not vilify them. The America I love has always been about looking forward, not backward, about working together to find solutions, regardless of party, instead of allowing our differences to divide us and hold us back. And we Democrats are committed to creating the opportunity for every American to succeed by growing our economy with good-paying jobs, educating and training our people to fill those jobs, giving our businesses the freedom to innovate, keeping our country safe, and providing health care that families can afford and rely on. Mr. President, as a candidate, you promised to be a champion for families struggling to make ends meet, and I hope you live up to that promise. But one of your very first executive orders makes it harder for those families to even afford a mortgage. Then you started rolling back rules that provide oversight of the financial industry and safeguard us against another national economic meltdown. And you picked a cabinet of billionaires and Wall Street insiders who want to eviscerate the protections that most Americans count on and that help level the playing field. That's not being our champion. That's being Wall Street's champion. And even more troubling, you and your Republican allies in Congress seem determined to rip affordable health insurance away from millions of Americans who most need it. Does the Affordable Care Act need some repairs? Sure it does. But so far, every Republican idea to replace the Affordable Care Act would reduce the number of Americans covered, despite your promises to the contrary. Mr. President, folks here in Kentucky expect you to keep your word, because this isn't a game. It's life and death for people. These ideas promise access to care, but deny the importance of making care affordable and effective. They would charge families more for fewer benefits and put the insurance companies back in control. Behind these ideas is the belief that folks at the lower end of the economic ladder just don't deserve health care, that it's somehow their fault that their employer doesn't offer insurance or that they can't afford to buy expensive health plans. But just who are these 22 million Americans, including 500,000 people right here in Kentucky, who now have health care that didn't have it before? Look, they're not aliens from some distant planet. They're our friends and our neighbors. We sit in the bleachers with them on Friday night. We worship in the pews with them on Sunday morning. They're farmers, restaurant workers, part-time teachers, nurses' aides, construction workers, and entrepreneurs working at high-tech startups. And before the Affordable Care Act, they woke up every morning and went to work, just hoping and praying they wouldn't get sick, because they knew that they were just one bad diagnosis away from bankruptcy. You know, in 2010, this country made a commitment that every American deserved health care they could afford and rely on. And we Democrats are going to do everything in our power to keep President Trump and the Republican Congress from reneging on that commitment. But we're going to need your help by speaking out. Another commitment now being tested is to our national security. Look, make no mistake, I'm a military veteran myself, and I know that protecting America is a president's highest duty. Yet President Trump is ignoring serious threats to our national security from Russia, who's not our friend, while alienating our allies who fought with us side by side and are our friends in a dangerous world. His approach makes us less safe and should worry every freedom-loving American. Instead, President Trump has all but declared war on refugees and immigrants. Look, the president can and should enforce our immigration laws, but we can protect America without abandoning our principles and our moral obligation to help those fleeing war and terror, without tearing families apart, and without needlessly jeopardizing our military men and women fighting overseas. You know, another Republican president, Ronald Reagan, once said, "In America, our origins matter less than our destination." And that is what democracy is all about. President Trump also needs to understand that people may disagree with him from time to time, but that doesn't make them his enemies. When the president attacks the loyalty and credibility of our intelligence agencies, the court system, the military, the free press, individual Americans, simply because he doesn't like what they say, he's eroding our democracy, and that's reckless. Real leaders don't spread derision and division. Real leaders strengthen. They unify, they partner, and they offer real solutions instead of ultimatums and blame. Look, I may be old-fashioned, but I still believe that dignity, compassion, honesty, and accountability are basic American values. And as a Democrat, I believe that if you work hard, you deserve the opportunity to realize the American dream, regardless of whether you're a coal miner in Kentucky, a teacher in Rhode Island, an auto worker in Detroit, or a software engineer in San Antonio. Our political system is broken. It's broken because too many of our leaders think it's all about them. They need to remember that they work for us, and helping us is their work. Kentucky made real progress while I was governor because we were motivated by one thing: helping families. Democrats are trying to bring the same focus back to Washington, D.C. Americans are a diverse people, and we may disagree on a lot of things, but we've always come together when we remember that we are one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
And with the Democratic response there by former Kentucky Governor Stephen Beshear, we wrap up almost 90 minutes of political discussion. Two very different perspectives from two very different perspectives.